Voters across South Florida are being asked to elect candidates for things they've never had to vote on before. What does it mean for how your local government works? I'm Danny Rivero. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Tim Padgett is out this week. Voters in Miami-Dade and Broward will have to elect new positions like sheriff, supervisor of elections, and tax collector. Also, state regulations passed after the Surfside condo collapse are coming into effect soon, and it's already impacting the real estate market. Finally, a look ahead to Venezuela's presidential election this Sunday. Will the Maduro regime allow an honest vote to take place? All that and more on the South Florida Roundup this hour. But first, the news. I'm Danny Rivero. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. 6 years ago, statewide voters passed a ballot amendment that mandated that every county in the state needs to elect five totally independent constitutional offices. Those include the sheriff, clerk of courts, property appraiser, tax collector, and supervisor of elections. That requirement is going into effect this year, meaning right now. Two of the only three counties impacted by these new rules across the state are here in South Florida. Broward County voters will soon elect a tax collector, a job that was previously handled in-house by the county government. And Miami-Dade residents will soon have to elect a county sheriff, a tax collector, and a supervisor of elections. All of those offices have up till now been under the county mayor's office. What does it mean to have these new independent elected offices? And how could it affect your services? Do you have questions? You can call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. We hope you do call. And joining us now to talk about this is Carlton Gillespie, WLRN intern, who's been covering this in Broward County. And also joining us is Miami-Dade County Commissioner Raquel Regalado. Commissioner Carlton, thanks for coming on.
Thanks. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So, Carlton, let's start with you here. Broward voters, as I mentioned, will soon elect a tax collector for the first time. But I want to mention, like, just calling it tax collector is a little bit misleading because that office handles all sorts of functions for the local and the state government. Can you tell us, like, what does that office actually involve?
Right. So outside of that tax collecting business, right, of ad valorem revenue, which is the largest, you know, tax base in the state, they also do things like, you know, car and boat registration, tag and titles, renew and update your driver's license, and collect property tax. So essentially, they oversee the functions of the DMV.
But which is not a small thing.
No, it's, and I think it's the thing that'll probably maybe most directly impact people on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, with the tax collector, that means they can also control, you know, how many branch offices they have, whether they have weekend hours or extended hours, and, you know, some sort of online reservation system to reduce wait times. And in Broward specifically, there's a ton of these privately owned tag and title companies. And the county tax collector could, if they wanted to, either abolish them or negotiate with them for lower rates, because the private tag companies, they have better hours, but they charge, you know, significantly more than the tax collector.
And Commissioner Regalado, I want to bring you into this. Miami-Dade, as I mentioned, will soon elect a tax collector too. How will making that office independent and elected change those services here in Miami-Dade?
Well, first of all, this was a state mandate to create these offices, to make them completely independent from the county, to take power away from the mayor. And also, their funding is different, right? So we have to approve their budget, but they can appeal that to the governor's cabinet, which is a completely different dynamic from what these departments had when they were under the umbrella of the county. They're also partisan seats, which really was the impetus of this, was to create a countywide partisan base. And give or take, there was the Republicans and Democrats, but overall, the idea was to create this space where people could run countywide for these positions. So in terms of the county, it has a huge impact. This is the most significant thing that has happened in Miami-Dade County since the creation of single-member districts. The impact on our finances is astronomical. And for many, many years, the county didn't deal with it. When I got elected in 2020, that was one of my big complaints, like, why aren't we dealing with this? Broward actually was ahead of the game. Broward started dealing with this, and one of the things they did is they changed the state law so that the clerk was not in charge of the finances of Broward County.
Right. And in Broward, they had a CFO that was in the administration. And then now some of those functions are going to be under the clerk of courts. So like the actual structure of the government has to change.
Exactly. At Miami-Dade County, I asked to do that. I finally got this to the commission 2 years ago when Joe Martinez released the holds and we had this whole thing about it. But when we finally got to it, I requested to keep our Miami-Dade County police officers because we function as a municipality, different than Broward. We have this unincorporated area, and I made the argument that we were a municipal government, which we are in many ways, but the statute was then changed to prevent us from doing that. They took all of our police officers, and they refused to allow us to tweak the clerk of the court. So now for Miami-Dade County, this means that the clerk of the court is the CFO and is the person that's going to be handling our finances for the entire county with a procurement system that's already problematic.
I want to jump in there for a second. What do these changes actually mean? Because as I understand it, a lot of these functions, they're now overseen by the county commission. So the sheriff's office, for example, like, the district commissioners have some kind of a say or a direct line to the police director, and with a sheriff, like,
we don't set policy anymore.
You don't set policy anymore, flat out.
We don't set policy anymore. It is up to the sheriff. The sheriff can take it or leave it, can listen to the county commission or not. We approve their budget, but if we don't approve their budget, they can actually go to the governor's cabinet. And there's case law in two counties already that says that even after the county commission approves their budget, they can move within line items without the county being able to do or say anything.
I want to just clarify that for listeners. So if the county sets a budget, say for the tax collector who's going to be newly elected, the tax collector who's elected says, I don't like that budget, governor, cabinet, increase my budget, would that potentially cut into, say, like the parks budget? Can they cut money out of other parts of the budget to fill it out?
What happens is that would happen after we set the millage. So it would have to come back to the county commission and we would have to find the money, right? So we would have to defund something in order to provide that office with the amount that the governor and his cabinet have determined that they quote unquote need in order to run the office. So for us, it's a huge financial burden. I said 4 years ago that at a minimum it was going to be $30 million, and I asked the Board of County Commissioners to establish a fund where we could put this money away. That first year in 2020, I put $10 million into that fund. This year, we're putting another $11 in there. $30 is not going to be enough. It's a completely change. It changes completely how our systems work. And all these employees now are no longer part of the county. They go to these independent offices, and these independent offices can legislate and can have legislative agendas that are separate and apart from the county. There's also a lot of things that the state is giving these offices to do that are unfunded mandates, like running the state licenses for the tax collector. It's an unfunded mandate. They're going to have to do it. And the question is, who's going to pay for it and how much is it going to cost?
Thank you for that. There's a lot to digest there. Carlton, I do want to ask you, keeping with the tax collectors, when in Broward County this converts into an elected position, it's going to change in some ways, as the commissioner was just saying. But one potential difference is the people doing that work now are appointed. They're professionals. They have experience in this. Are there any kind of qualifications for someone running for this now elected partisan office?
Yeah, I think you're touching on the most crucial part of this is that we're going to move from professional administration of these services to political administration of these services. And to answer your question, no. In Broward County, there's no specific thing that you need to do other than qualify to run as a candidate, listing assets over $1,000, ensuring that you're not in a particular debt and paying the registration fees, and you too could be tax collector.
I could be sheriff.
There's no requirements for sheriff. You don't have to be a police officer in order to run for sheriff. And listen, I think that some of these offices, it'll be good because there'll be some accountability, right? But there's also no term limits and they can't be recalled.
And Miami-Dade and Broward governments, I do want to mention, were both strongly against this ballot amendment in 2018. They were both saying it just wasn't needed. There was no scandal that preceded it or anything. And I talked to then county mayor and now Republican Congressman Carlos Jimenez about it back in 2018. And these were his thoughts on it.
I don't see a big, you know, nothing really happened to cause this. You know, wow, there's a big scandal and we got to change the form of government. There was something else going on. I really haven't put my finger on it. Maybe some people wanted more political positions, more elected positions here in this county. I, you know, being a politician myself, I don't think we need any more politicians. Thank you very much.
So, Commissioner, I want to ask you about that specifically, actually, when it comes to the supervisor of elections. You know, in that election in 2018, there was huge issues in Broward County. They had an elected supervisor of elections for many years, Brenda Snipes, got in a lot of controversy for how that was administered. And here in Miami-Dade, we ran extremely smooth elections in 2018. We had an appointed professional, Christina White, who's still our supervisor. Do you fear on some level that by moving the supervisor of elections office from, you know, a professional with experience to a political election could bring some problems or growing pains in that?
Well, the professional staff is still going to be there, right? And they still have to follow the state of Florida law. So there isn't that much they can deviate from. We have to see what they use their resources on, right? And how they could potentially politicize the office. It is now going to be a partisan election, right? So that adds something a little concerning to that dynamic. My biggest issue with that particular office is that that person has their election on a presidential year, which makes no sense to me because that person should be on a gubernatorial year. I want the supervisor of elections to be focused on elections on a presidential. I don't want them running their own campaign. That's a little absurd to me. So if anyone should be on an off year, it's that department if we're going to have a supervisor of elections, because you kind of have the fox in charge of the hen house, right, on the most important year. And these people are going to be deciding. For example, we have in Miami-Dade County, we have more days of early voting than Broward does, right? We do 2 weeks, they do one. These are decisions that are made by the election supervisor that will be made by the new elected director of elections, you know. So, you know, things could get a little out of control in terms of them making decisions based on their own election. So that's what I'm concerned about in the next few years as these offices flush out.
And I want to open up the lines again. If anyone has a call, you can reach us here at the South Florida Roundup at 800-743-9576. Again, that's 800-743-9576. And I'm Danny Rivero. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're talking about why South Florida voters will soon elect officials to new independent offices like tax collector, sheriff, and supervisor of elections. We're talking with WLRN intern Carlton Gillespie and Miami-Dade County Commissioner Raquel Regalado. Commissioner, you know, one thing I do want to ask you about is the cost of doing this. You know, these are going to be elected positions. Okay, we can run an election, but what's the actual cost of making these offices independent?
Well, our initial estimate is $30 million, like I said. I think it's going to be a lot more than that because these departments currently use county services. And what we're going to see is over time, they're going to pick and choose. Do they want to ride along with us on health insurance? Do they want to ride along with us on insurance? Do they want to stay in our buildings or do they want to rent their own buildings? Do they want to have more buildings? Do they want to have more staff? Do they want to have less staff? Do they want to pay their staff more? So I think the first year is going to be interesting to see the negotiation. In the case of the police, we were able in Tallahassee to say that they have to use our services for 3 years. And I am bringing an item that went to committee and now goes to the full board in September, where we're giving the sheriff the jails because we can't do the jails without a police force. It doesn't make any sense. Like, I'm going to call the sheriff when I have a problem at the jails. So we have to have a complete system. They took our police, so now we need to give them the jails. And there are concerns about the costs associated with that. And a lot of county commissioners are relitigating this idea of our loss of policy control. For example, we spent a lot of time doing all this work on suspended licenses. Out the window now.
I see. The sheriff. I see. The county has been working on that for years, right?
Yeah, the sheriff can take it or leave it. But this is the new reality that we find ourselves in. And that's why I've kept telling my colleagues that we have to redefine our identity as a regional service provider. We are now a regional government, and we do not have access to these other departments. We can make suggestions, but they don't have to listen to us,
right?
Because they can always go to the governor. And it could potentially cost us hundreds of millions of dollars, but it could also create the full incorporation of Miami-Dade County and turn Miami-Dade County's strong government into a Broward County weak county commission that simply administers regional services. So that is within the realm of what could happen.
That's very interesting. And, you know, in Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava's proposed budget for the next fiscal year, as you mentioned, she's expecting to spend about $30 million on making the switch to all these independent offices. And she pointed to that and said that's why she's not recommending tax rate cuts this year like we've had over the last couple of years. Do you expect the tail end of this, I mean, all these costs are gonna, you know, affect taxpayers for a few years?
First and foremost, I mean, I pulled the millage and I voted against it because keeping the millage flat is not reducing taxes, right? Your property values go up every year, so if I keep the millage flat, you're paying more. I've always taken issue with the way that this is, explained to people. So first and foremost, I've been for reducing taxes. People are at a point where they can't anymore. Last year, I was able to find some money and help our seniors like I did the year before. I'm hoping to do that again this year through the Save Our Seniors program. But the reality is that the cost of living here is out of control. These two things are coming, the lack of affordability, the raise in taxes, the raise in the garbage that was against. Which they passed at the last budget. And this will not impact us fiscally this year, but next year in 2026 is where we're really going to see how painful this transition was.
We've been talking with Miami-Dade County Commissioner Raquel Regalado and also with WLRN intern Carlton Gillespie about the major changes happening in local government. Thank you both so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Three years ago, the Champlain Tower South building in Surfside collapsed, leaving 98 people dead. The massive tragedy drew international attention. And as the dust settled, Florida lawmakers passed strict new bipartisan laws regulating condos. New regulations. The laws are meant to stop condo associations from kicking the can down the road and avoiding needed repairs. But now, months from when that law is going into effect, the new mandates have become a sticker shock for thousands of condo residents. Special assessments, sometimes adding up to hundreds of thousands of dollars, are being levied on condo units. Retirees and working families often say they simply can't keep up with it. The laws only impact condos that are more than 30 years old. And now those older condos are flooding the real estate market as owners are trying to cut their losses and get out. As the rest of the real estate market stays strong in South Florida, the cost of these older condos is actually coming down. Is this an issue that's affecting you or your family, these special assessments, this new law? You can call us and join the conversation at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. A reporter paying a lot of attention to all of this is Tom Hudson, WLRN Senior Economics Editor and Special Correspondent. Thanks. Tom, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, terrific. Right? I appreciate you having us on, and really important topic here.
It really is. And, you know, first question, Tom, just please break down a little for us about what these new policies going into effect of January 1st next year actually do.
Yeah, there's kind of three big ones. There's a lot of them, but there's three significant ones that are impacting people who live in these older condominium buildings and affecting the market for condominiums that are 30 years old or older, those that are on the market looking for buyers. So the first one is that condominium buildings that are at least three stories tall, they have to be inspected if they're over 30 years old, and then they have to be inspected every 10 years after that. So they need a kind of a visual inspection, and then if an engineer sees something visually, then they have to go for have a further inspection. Obviously and clearly directly related reform from the Surfside tragedy three years ago.
Right.
The second significant change is that condominium associations in buildings at least three stories tall can no longer, as you say, kick the can down the road. They can no longer just waive reserves and say, you know what, we're not going to collect any extra money today or this year. We're not going to have a rainy day fund because it would increase assessments or there would be a, we're not going to do that. Previously, they could do that for as long as they could do that, right? For as long as the board would approve it, they can no longer do that. That has to stop. That practice ends completely.
Which is totally different.
Enormous difference. And the third big difference relates to both of those together is that the associations have to properly fund the repairs that are necessary in order for a building to be fully and appropriately maintained. So all of that together, Danny, means that there are, as you point out, significant assessments that already condominium owners are facing or likely to face in the next several years.
And you reported this week for WLRN that about 9 out of 10 condos on the market right now in South Florida, that's Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach,
yep.
almost 9 out of 10 of the condos on the market are 30 years old or more.
Yeah.
And so those are the same units that are being subjected to these new mandates.
That's right.
Why is that so notable?
Well, because, so first of all, most of the condominiums in Florida are going to be older condominiums, right? You can only build so many condominiums each year.
Right.
So by default, that happens. But what has happened is as these reforms have woken up condominium associations and owners, many of those owners have realized, oh, we don't have any reserves in our building association or very little reserves. And the roof has some problems, or I see something maybe on a balcony that may be something. And I would rather sell first and ask questions later. And so you have a significant number of these older vintage condominiums that that are at least 30 years old, just crowding the market and have been building up an inventory and supply and demand, lots of supply. And very little demand means these prices that we're seeing are going down in the market, in addition to buyers asking more significant questions and sellers required to financially disclose the balance sheets of their buildings. Buyers will say, I see the special assessment. I want that haircut off the price.
Right. And exactly. I was going to clarify that the cost for the unit might come down, but you might be expecting significant upticks on.
That's right.
On your condo.
So you've got a $500,000 condominium in South Florida, which is higher than the average, but say that it's $500,000. And say that condominium is responsible for $100,000 of special assessments for the building because the reserves hadn't been funded and there's some structural questions or maybe a roof or something like that. An interested buyer is going to come in and say, well, why would I pay $500,000 asking price and be faced with a $100,000 bill that I know is going to happen there? So the seller then is incentivized to have to essentially reduce their price to accommodate that special assessment.
Take a haircut.
That's right.
I want to go to the phones now. We have Tim calling from Miami Beach. Tim, thanks for calling the South Florida Roundup. You're on the line.
Yeah, hi. I live in an older condominium, and we've just been assessed a very large special assessment. For a lot of people, retired people like myself, it is a big burden. I can now afford it, but there are many people in our buildings supposedly that cannot. And so we're thinking that a lot of people who may have lived here for years are going to be forced to sell. And I guess the theme of the whole thing is that can drive down prices because so many people will be looking to sell. I don't know that it's necessarily happening in my building yet, but it could be, and I think everybody needs to be concerned.
Well, thank you for the call, Tim. You know, Tom, I do want to draw attention to this because, and I want to draw a distinction between the quote unquote market
mm-hmm.
and the immediate impact
mm-hmm.
of all these changes
mm-hmm.
for thousands and thousands of people
yeah.
who currently own these condos. Like, what, as Tim was just talking about, he can afford it.
Right.
Who knows how much more he can afford. But can you talk about that?
Yeah. So big difference for Tim, who owns a condo, can afford the special assessments, wants to keep his condominium, right? Wants to keep it as an asset. Maybe he lives in it full time or wants to give it, you know, in the family, whatever that may be. The impact that they have, that owners like Tim have, is to kind of weather this storm right now in order to make sure that his building finances are in good shape over the next few years, that they're starting to put aside that rainy day fund that they're required to under the new legislation. It sounds like some of Tim's neighbors may not have the financial wherewithal to deal with those special assessments and then maybe pushed into the for sale market, and now you've got a condominium that's down the hall or maybe above or below Tim, and maybe there's lots of them in his building that are going to hit the market for sale because those owners don't want to or unable to pay for those special assessments.
I'm Danny Rivero. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN, and we're talking with WLRN's senior economics editor Tom Hudson about condo laws that were passed after the Surfside condo collapse that are going into effect soon, and the impact that those laws are having on the market and on families. You can call us at 800-743-9576.
I'll say it's a double whammy. There's the special assessments to catch up, and then there's the increase in the ongoing monthly assessments to make sure that the ongoing repairs or needed maintenance are funded as well. And that's what a lot of these owners of these older condominiums are facing. It's the catch-up piece of years and years and years of deferral. And then it's, well, what do we need to be collecting each and every month so that we no longer are kicking the can down the road?
And, you know, for a long time, condos have generally been a cheaper way to own a home.
Yep.
And, you know, all this catch-up talk, it presents the question of, have condos remained so affordable for so long, partly because all this maintenance was delayed?
It's a great question. I think the anecdotal answer is yes, because you have owners of condominiums voting in usually their own interest of members of this board.
And they'd be voting to assess themselves thousands of dollars,
right? And if something is perhaps it looks cosmetic, or maybe it's not something that needs attention today, anybody who owns a piece of property is probably guilty of this. I'm certainly guilty of it as a single family homeowner. I can get to that next month or get to that next year. Maybe the budget here is a little bit tight. Over the course of 30 years, right, that adds up very, very quickly. And in the case of the Champlain Towers, has tragic consequences.
And Tom, in your piece this week for WLRN, you spoke with ISG Worldwide CEO Craig Studnicki, and he talked a little bit about how this new dynamic is playing out on the market. Let's take a listen.
Buyers that are moving to Florida, they're specifically asking realtors, don't take me to one of those. Those would be a building that is more than likely going to get tagged with a special assessment. Bring me somewhere new.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is the supply side, or rather the demand side, right? Where the buyers are coming from. Population increases have continued in South Florida, which is great news for existing property owners. You have more people competing for the property. However, as Craig points out, and we should point out, he's on oftentimes the sell side. He's looking to find buyers and work with buyers and sellers. Many of those who are moving through, anecdotally, as he says, are aware of these reforms and are aware of the financial impact of these reforms on older buildings. And instead of looking at a building and thinking about how the financial calculus may work, let's just take those off the table and only focus on condominiums that are in buildings that are, say, 10 years old or less or 20 years old or less that may not be subject to these reforms.
And, you know, on the market side, we've been talking about the sales, right?
Yep.
And part of your reporting suggested that some condo buildings and associations might be pushed to actually open more units up for rentals, which would be a big change.
This was a fascinating piece from Ken Johnson, who's a longtime real estate economist at Florida Atlantic University, saying, you know, many of these condominium owners may be faced with these special assessments and higher monthly assessments, but yet do not want to take that haircut on a sale price. Instead, may be forced to put this supply into the rental market, which would increase the number of apartments essentially in the market. But it'll come up against bylaws in many of these condominium associations that have been...
they'll have to change them, basically.
A lot of those bylaws are reluctant, if not outright restrict, the kind of rental properties can happen.
Right. I want to go to the phones now. We have Peter calling from Little Havana. Peter, thanks for calling. You're on the radio.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. A fantastic coverage. I want to applaud you for that. I wanted to point out, I'm a consultant related to condos. And in dealing with engineers, one of the issues that's coming up is they simply don't have enough people to go out and perform the structural integrity reserve studies. One engineer told me about a month ago that if you give him the money today for a contract, he'll probably see you in 6 months, which is after the law kicks in, which is January 2025.
Thank you, Peter. And we have another caller I want to go to. Teresita calling from Miami. Teresita, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hello, yes, sir. I pretty much, I'm going on the same line. I understand we have to have reserves. In our condo, we have been voting no reserves, and we have solved all our problems, you know, with special assessment. Okay, we understand we cannot do it anymore. But why don't they do a special session in you know, our government to change the way they're doing it? They should give us more time, not just, like the gentleman said, it's 25, it starts already. It's barely any time to... to get everything done, and if they give us more time, it will be less money up front. Everybody in my building is retired, so you know it's not easy.
Fixed incomes, huh? Thank you so much for the call, Teresita. Tom, to that point, is there discussion about changing the law, something like that?
There is a discussion around reforming the reforms slightly, giving people a little bit more time, right? Building up the reserves as opposed to just on a specific day having to have that full amount in there. So extending some of this, but not letting go of the rationale behind it. And to the caller's point, Peter's point about just the lack of qualified engineers. What we've been told is that if association members can show that they have that contract in 6 months, that ought to satisfy at least regulatory concerns that the building's not following through with the spirit and the letter of the law.
Because they showed that they're making steps towards it.
That's right. That's right.
Right. Yeah. And where does this leave us in the short term, at least?
So it's a lot of chaos in the condominium market in Florida. And here's the other thing, Danny. You know, from a regulatory standpoint, there's a lot of lawmakers that have looked at the condominium issue as really a South Florida. They're concentrated in South Florida, right? These rules apply statewide. So now you've got the condominium owners in Panama City and condominium owners on the Space Coast and condominium owners in Marco Island and Fort Myers. All of this is now in one market having to deal with these reforms. And the great majority of condominiums in the state of Florida are older than 30 years old.
Tom Hudson is WLRN's senior economics editor. He will continue following this story, I know. Many thanks for coming on, Tom.
Thank you, Danny. Appreciate it.
This Sunday, a presidential election is taking place in Venezuela, a country that's lost about a third of its population due to government mismanagement of the economy, political repression, record inflation, etc., etc. All eyes are on this pivotal election that comes after years of talks with the opposition. But that doesn't mean it's been easy to get here. The dictatorial regime of socialist president Nicolás Maduro has systematically set up roadblock after roadblock for the opposition, including barring opposition leader Maria Corina Machado from holding public office. Machado's replacement candidate for the opposition, Edmundo González, leads by massive margins in every legitimate public opinion poll in that country. But will the Maduro regime actually allow a fair election to happen when it would probably mean the end of the socialist revolution started by former President Hugo Chavez? What's at stake for the region in this election? And how are Venezuelan exiles here in South Florida making their voices heard? Joining us to talk about this is Maria Alejandra Marquez, who handles communications for Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. And also joining us is Beatriz Olavarria, a business consultant who is helping organize Venezuelan exiles here in Florida. Maria Alejandra and Beatriz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Maria Alejandra, let's start with you. It's taken many years and countless talks and debates to get here. What's at stake in this election this Sunday between Nicolás Maduro, the dictatorial president, as I said, and opposition figure Edmundo González?
Well, I would say that there is a lot at stake, not only for the future of Venezuela, but for the future of the region. As you mentioned, all the situation that was created by the corruption, the incapacity, and the mismanagement of the Maduro government has created not only the direst humanitarian crisis in the country, but in the region. We have 7.7 million Venezuelans that have migrated or are refugees, and that are creating instability not only in the whole region, but also in here in the United States, in our borders. So whatever happens this Sunday will be critical for the future of the stability of the region.
And Beatriz, I want to ask you, you know, as I mentioned, there's been so many roadblocks thrown up by the Maduro regime, but the election looks like it's going to take place. And for the first time, there's not a major boycott of one side or the other on this election. Would you say that, at least from the people you talk to in Venezuela, are people looking at Sunday as a real legitimate election and not a kind of sham election?
Yes. I do think that they look at it and feel it, because it's more of a feeling. If you watched any of the, you know, congregations that Maria Corina has had, and, you know, the multitude of people who come out fearless, which is fearless, because if you understand that in many of those places they will identify you, and then they will give you, they won't give you the clap bag of some kind of food that they distribute, and they probably will close your establishment if she stops and gets something to drink on the way, because Maria Corina cannot fly in any airline or even in private airlines in Venezuela. So she goes by car.
And so, you know, the videos coming out of those rallies. The videos coming out of Maria Corina's rallies around the country have, I mean, it's truly impressive. Massive, massive crowds. People greeting her, the caravans through the country. I mean, it's clearly not just, you know, it's not just a name. There's a lot of emotion and buy-in from the general public there.
I mean, you can't even hold your own. What you feel when you see those things is just appalling, and there's absolute faith in her. And they trust her, and it is something really astonishing in that sense. And that's why I say that, you know, they don't have fear anymore. They don't care of whatever they're going to be stripped of. And it's just that. I think it's very, very powerful, this situation. And obviously, I do think that they see themselves lost, many of them, realistically speaking. And they have much of their team detained, some in the Argentinian embassy, others detained in Helicoides. And you know, they detained her security guards, and they are obviously trying to do what they do. But yet I do think that people are aware of the importance of being in the centers and being with the witnesses that are inside, mm-hmm. and staying until the end, and being at the end when they count. There's a 54% that has to be counted, and you have to open to the public. So there's a whole thing of, you know, we are not going to leave this post until we know it's right.
And Maria Alejandra, I want to ask you, you know, last week President Maduro said that there could be a bloodbath if he loses the election. And those comments sparked rare criticism from Brazilian president and fellow leftist Lula da Silva. How serious are you and the opposition taking that threat of violence?
Oh, I mean, every Venezuelan has been living with violence coming from the government for the last 25 years. This is nothing new. of course, what they are trying is to create more fear, to make people to try to avoid people from going to the polls and voting. But the thing is, what we see in Venezuela is that people know the risks. When you asked before if we believe that these elections are going to be fair, they are not going to be fair. At the moment, there are more than 70 incarcerations of activists and parts of the political team of Maria Corina. There are 60 organizations that have been blocked in Venezuelan carriers just to send fact-checked information since the electoral campaign started. Only 13 have been this week. Media outlets, web pages, fact-checking sites. So this government is doing everything they can to make sure Maduro appears as a winner on Sunday. The difference now is that people have heard this, have known it, have been living this for decades. This is nothing new for Venezuelans. The difference now is that they are willing to go and vote and protect the vote regardless of all this. They know the risk. Every Venezuelan knows the risk. There are a lot of people. Look, Provea, which is the oldest human rights organization in Venezuela, reported that in the 13 years of Maduro government, there have been 10,000 people killed by government security forces. Just think about that, from 2013 and to 2023. There have been almost 2,000 victims of torture. So people know exactly what they are facing. People you know have been detained. People you know have been pressured by the government to be silenced. So when Beatriz mentioned the word fearless, that's what we're seeing in the Venezuelan population. Mm-hmm. And this is inspiring and humbling, really, to see.
I'm Danny Rivero. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're talking about the stakes and the realities of this Sunday's presidential election in Venezuela. We're speaking with Maria Alejandra Marquez and Beatriz Olavarria, two South Florida-based exiles. Beatriz, I want to bring you back into it. The exiled Venezuelans in the U.S. and also across the whole world have essentially been banned from voting in this election. But that does not mean that they're sitting it out from here in South Florida, especially. What role is the exile community playing in this election from here?
Well, there are two of them. One of them is asking the people. They're a really beautiful campaign saying, since I can't vote, be my key. You vote for me, kind of like, you know, because there are always those neutral kind of people that, you know, would not make the effort, or they're scared to do it, or however that goes. So, you know, calling them to please vote for you because you don't have the opportunity to do it is one. And the other one is through comanditos. There are people that are helping in the centers for the witnesses or their friends, so that they have how to get there and then go back home. For the elderly people, you have somebody who picks them up and takes them so that they can also vote. I mean, everybody's doing everything.
You mentioned these
food and all that. It's really beautiful.
You mentioned these comanditos, these little command centers are kind of serving as little hubs to help people figure out how exactly to vote, because you know, one of the things we've heard is that they've changed the name of some of the polling sites at the last minute. It's the same place, but they change the name and kind of throw people off.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. They're trying their best to confuse. There are certain voting centers that polling stations that are, for example, there's one in Puerto Tuna. You can imagine the results. So they also migrated a bunch of new voters to those centers or voting polls. So yeah, they've kind of tried to figure it out in that sense. And yes, nobody's going to go in Puerto Tuna to go, and you know, you would be kind of crazy to do that. So right. Those votes are for sure for the regime, but we are going to protect our votes. We are. And that's another thing that we are helping out here, because after late night and it's dark, people are offering transportation through motorcycles or even, you know, rental cars or
kind of just helping people get to the polls and actually
exactly,
exercise
so that they can stay and be safe.
Right. Mm-hmm. Maria Alejandra, you know, I want to ask you, and you said that, you know, people are under no illusions that this is going to be a fair election. Does that leave room for actual real hope? I mean,
oh, yes.
Can you tell me about that?
That's what's been wonderful about this process that we've been living the last year. Look, if you had asked me a year ago, if I had believed that the government would allow for primaries, I would have laughed. As a miscalculation, they allowed it. And the reason why they allowed it is because they thought that the spirit of people was crushed. They thought people were not going to participate because they've been so repressed and politically abused for so many years that people were just not going to participate. And people showed up and voted. And those primaries brought the result of a strong candidate that was supported. People wanted her to run. And when they saw what they were doing to her to avoid her from running, they just got more energized. And they think knowing the difficulties that we have come to the point that we have come today, I would say I'm not a religious person in particular, but I would say it's short of a miracle. Just to have risen this amount of hope in the Venezuelan people and to realize that we have tried everything. As Venezuelans, we have tried everything. And we now know that the only resource that we have is the vote, the participation, and the making sure of that vote is counted. So not only people are organizing to vote, they are organizing to stay at the centers and check that the vote is not ignored or violated. And that is very powerful. People are learning that is very powerful. They know it's going to be hard. They know that the possibilities are slim because the government is going to do everything in their power to avoid it. But what we don't know, and I think what people are hoping, is that there will be a crack in the system, that we don't know how the military is going to react at the end. We can have theories based on what has happened before, but other dictatorships and authoritarian regimes have fallen when they lose the support of the people in the extent in which it has been lost in Venezuela. People do really want change.
Sorry to cut you off, but we only have a few more seconds here. Mm-hmm. I want to quickly ask, what are the plans for the community on Sunday as the votes and the results come back in? Maria Alejandra.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think Beatriz can speak in better detail because she's coordinating all that. But basically, apart from helping from here people to vote there, we're organizing here to send information that is accurate, that is fact-checked. We're trying to send information to our family, relatives, to everyone that we know and we can, what is going on, how can they be safe, how can they help out. And they will be, I think, Beatriz, you can explain more about the activities.
I'm sorry, we'll get something on our website, but we have to wrap it up.
All right.
Thank you both so much, Maria Alejandra Marquez and Beatriz Olavarria, Venezuelan exiles here in South Florida. I wish you all the best luck this weekend.
Thank you so much.
Finally, on the South Florida Roundup, the 2024 Olympic Games in Paris are kicking off today as we speak with the opening ceremony. And Delray Beach native and tennis star Coco Gauff and former Miami resident LeBron James are the Team USA flag bearers. And they're not the only athletes with South Florida ties participating in the games. More than 50 athletes from here are competing in Paris. A 14-year-old swimmer from Boca Raton, Maya Chalut, will represent Haiti in the 50-meter freestyle sprint. She told WLRN she's ready to make her family proud.
Let me tell you, it was like a big shocker for me. I didn't think that was gonna happen, especially like since I'm only 14. And I think doing that 50 free will get me an opportunity to show how fast I can go in such a short amount of time.
Another swimmer and Florida International University student, Nicole Frank, is competing for the second time representing Uruguay. She has swimming in her genes as her grandmother, Nelly Romero, qualified to represent Germany at the 1940 Helsinki Olympic Games. But those games were canceled due to World War II. Frank told FIU her grandmother would be very proud if she knew where she was standing now.
It's really motivating for me to carry on with that legacy and to live this dream for her. Even though she's not here with us anymore, I know she's looking from above.
Best of luck to all of them. And Frank will be competing in the 200-meter individual medley. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It's produced by Jimena Romero with the help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mares. Richard Ives answers the phones. And I'm Danny Rivero. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. Go Team USA.